You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Torbjørn Rodland. Let me try that again. Today on our show, I'm talking with Torbjørn Rodland. Torbjørn, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hello. Good to talk to you.
We're talking about your show, of course, which I'm really looking forward to because I love the show, Bones in the Canal and Other Photographs, and hopefully listeners can go see this at David Kordansky Gallery. Today we're going to get into this a little bit and talk about your work. To begin with, just to step back, I want to talk about some individual works, but you've been working in photography for quite a while through, you know, kind of the modern history of photography going from film to digital. From what I understand, these are all film-based, right? And these are not digitally printed, everything in the show?
Yeah, so I never did go from film to digital. I've been staying with film in part because I have never been that interested in the technical aspects of photography and so the camera part. So I started as a student of photography in the mid to early 90s in Norway. I would work on a medium format camera, and then I would get to know the large format camera. And after studying, I bought one of each of those two formats, and I've been working with those formats since then, up until a couple of years ago when I picked up a 35mm camera and preferred to work with that.
So medium format, that's 3x5. Like, how do you, or large is 8x10. How do you? What's the exact format of the first two that you worked with?
So the medium format that I work with is 6x7. They make it complicated because they measure the medium format in centimeters, but the large format in inches. So it sounds bigger because the large format is 4x5, but that's in inches. So that negative is about 10x12 centimeters.
I did experiment
a little bit with 8x10 in school, but I didn't prioritize that extra size up when buying my own cameras.
And so after medium and large, you moved. It's not back to, but then you began using 35mm, the more common format, right? Which, of course, is, compared to those formats, quite a bit easier to shoot.
Yeah, it's the format that took over the amateur market, say, from the late 60s, early 70s. Before that, the amateur market was actually on medium format. And so when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, and that was the format that everyone was using. And when I started doing this a little bit more ambitiously, there wasn't really a digital alternative that could compete. And that's maybe also a reason why I never really started out on that route.
And 35mm now, for quite a while, is there a particular camera you use or a way you're using 35mm with or without a light meter?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of 35mm in the 90s when I started exhibiting, but it was very sort of point and shoot based. So I think partly because my compositions tend to be a little bit more controlled and I didn't really need the process to be simpler, I ended up with a Rollei that's actually quite complicated to work with. So it's very compact, all metal, but it doesn't tell you when anything is in focus, and I use a light, an external light meter that's actually bigger than the camera.
Wow, that's quite a complex process then, and so interesting. Well, that's closer to medium and large format, right? Isn't that similar to how we use medium and large format? I would imagine there is a separate light meter for that as well. And well, you can see what you're focusing on in those medium and large formats, though, right?
Exactly. So in that sense, it's more complicated to work with than the larger cameras. So in this exhibition, there's sort of examples of both. You first walked into the part that has the newer work from the 35mm, and then in the room in the back, there are slightly older, and some of them are like a lot older negatives from medium and large format negatives.
And so the Raleigh camera, I'm fascinated by that. Why that particular choice? I would think there's many cameras that would be a bit easier than that, that you could see more of what you're getting, right? I mean, I get that's also the magic of photography, right? Or originally, like, what is actually going to come out on this negative, or at least that's how I've seen it. But why that choice of the Raleigh, which seems to be cumbersome with the light meter and everything?
Yeah, it's I didn't really want to change the way that I was working with the medium and with what I'm looking at. So it's just I didn't need to change the pace. So I still sort of set things up and I still use for maybe half of the photographs in the show, like a large strobe lamp that's also a lot bigger than the cameras. And so I was drawn to it, and I like that it is that there is so many that there's so much room for error. I think mistakes have always been generative for me, so not quite knowing what you're getting, and also not and also depending on certain accidents and random effects and things have been sort of more central to my process than it probably seems like, because the photographs tend to seem more controlled in the end than they actually are.
That's so fascinating. And so since we're into process here, the darkroom, has the darkroom experience changed since moving to the Raleigh? Is there something different happening when making those prints? I mean, of course, they're not contact prints. You're using an enlarger. But yeah, did something change in the darkroom?
No, I tend to delegate that to I tend to work with printers. It's not important for me to be the one that smells the liquids and that holds the paper in the dark, but it's important to be outside and to make all the choices. But the it's just yeah, it's more the difference in what you get, and more importantly the how that feels and the associations for the individual viewer to the difference in photographic language. So one thing is the size of the negative, so that I'm welcoming grain for the first time, but also the lens in that camera is a little bit more wide angle than the longer lenses that I've used before. So that also creates a different type of pictorial space where there's more, where the background becomes or this becomes more activated, and the figure is typically then more in the middle of a room, whether it's indoor space or outdoors.
I want to talk about a few prints now. The first curtain, which has dates on it 2024 to 2026. Yeah, let's talk about this image. Really enigmatic, beautiful, beautiful image. First, the date range. Why 2024 to 2026?
Yeah, the code to that basically means the negative is from 2024 and the first print 2 years later. So it doesn't mean that that it takes that long to actually make the negative in any way, but that's sort of the key to the dating, and that's even more accentuated in the other room when you have an example of like a print that is 2008 to 26. So it means the same thing, that it's just been sitting around for a long time before the first print is made. And yeah, so the first curtain was made during residency I did in Arles with Luma in France. So I got access to all the rooms in that big art center, and some of them are not in use. So I found this big sort of post-industrial space with the columns and the curtains, and oh, everything was there. But of course, I added the figure, and then the rest was sort of improvised on set. But it's also an example of this. The backlighting that I've been working with pretty much for 30 years. First in nature with the direction of the sun, but also when I started working with my own flashlight that I realized that I preferred to put the light behind what I was looking at rather than next to the camera.
Yeah, the lighting is beautiful in here. So is there's a number of things that are so striking in here. All the triangles and a number of things about the composition. The figure, though, we're looking at what seems to be theatrical almost, right? With the big curtain, with the figure wearing what looks like something a mime would wear. And of course, this is staged by yourself, or as you say, it was if I understand correctly, a kind of improvisation or collaboration. How does that come about? Because that's partly what's striking about this image is the light, the composition, the color, the texture, the depth, and the blacks, but also this figure is doing something we don't quite understand, but we're drawn to. It's a pose that is something that I've never seen in my experience.
Yeah, it is. I think more than people realize that in photography, it's very often like an inside event that's been put outside, that's sort of and becomes alive, even divine. People are still pretty invested in this old-fashioned idea of sort of documenting reality. For me, that's never really been the core interest or how the medium operates for me. So, because I think that imagination in general perceives in a holistic, personified manner. And so just that in the same way that we do not create our dreams, that they happen to us, right? So I do not really invent the characters in the pictures fully. They sort of happen to me, or I stumble into them and they present themselves sort of as existing prior to any effort that I may have put in to shake something out of the hat. But of course, I still have to choose clothes and so on to some degree to get to a place where I can make a photograph that I would like to make, since I know that I won't be able to make the pictures that I want by just sort of walking around and hoping that things will happen in front of the camera. So there's this back and forth between setting a stage and then inviting someone onto the stage and having chosen the wardrobe, and then it's sort of improvisation from there on.
And the idea of going back to this dating, shot in 2024, printed in 2026, that's also very curious too. Why the 2 year lag, or sometimes greater? I would think, you know, images would get lost in that time, or your interests move on to other things. I've never seen this particular process before, or heard about this, where photographers are waiting to print because you're very likely involved in something else in 2 or 3 years, right? Or something has evolved. So that's kind of fascinating to me, how you keep record of those, and how do you go back to those. It almost makes me think of how when you look at older work, you think, wow, you know, this is a beauty. You see something in it that you didn't see at the time, and it's remarkable. But of course, that's just my association.
Yeah, no, it's actually not going back and rediscovering. It's more that I, just after the session, when I first see the results, then I go through a process. Maybe I have to sleep on it for the image that's sort of the best one from the session to stand out and sort of demand continuous existence or life, and then it's being put in a folder, and then I collect in that folder or in several folders if it's different bodies of work, and then it just waits around, and then when I have a format, whether it be an exhibition or a book that needs some content, and I go to see like what is the best or most individual family of images or collection that I can put together for this context. And then some images just never really fit in, or they take too much attention, or they are too obnoxious, so they can just wait around for a long time. When it comes to this body of work, I just haven't shown anything from this film format before, so that's why there hasn't really been an opportunity to do anything, except for that this photograph that you focus on, the first curtain, was the cover of a scene that I put out last year called Mimes.
And another image that I'd like to talk about, Forgetting Victoria. And this has one date in it, 2025. But for me, this is a very beautiful image. There's so many things going on here in terms of form and the construction of this image. There also seems to be a mood here. I don't know if I'm just, well, I am just reading into the title, Forgetting Victoria, but it feels to me there's an emotional tone to this that I that's different than the others. That feels it strikes me as powerful and potentially about a relationship. Could be about a city or something else, but there seems to be something a bit. Again, this is my association, a little heartrending here. And very unusual, of course, right? Because we're looking at a scene without any figures in it as well. I don't know if you want to react to what I'm saying or not, but there's a beautiful sense of something being torn here as well as something being put together. And so I'm reacting to what I think is a kind of a poetic overtone about loss.
Yeah, it's and some of the photographs I guess try to charge a little bit in this direction through the title, while others have more of a dry descriptive title. I don't know if you noticed, but in the background on the left, behind this weird white fencing, there's a sign where you can read the end of the name Victoria, and also a vertical sign that, if you could read Chinese, would spell out Victoria in Chinese, so how it's being translated into Chinese. So that sort of that name is in the background. So in that sense, it's about kind of moving on, and then all the possible destruction and weird recreation and damage to this vehicle that can happen in this process of moving on and putting something in the background. But this is a rare example in the exhibition of a photograph that is made in sort of a completely straight found manner, where I haven't moved the car to put it there. This is basically found the way that it appears, and there are a few examples of this in the show, but not that many.
Thank you, for sharing that. Right, that seems to really stand out to me. And the one more I'd like to talk about is Taverns of the Lamb, and this is 2024, 2026. Also, something very different happening here. I read a little bit about this in the press release as relating to music. But of course, there's a woman in this playing a violin. Well, that's what it appears she's doing. Gorgeous lighting in the background. Beautiful, beautiful colors here. And has that feeling of theater to some extent. But as I understand from what I've read about this, this also is reflecting on a genre. Is that correct?
Well, again, this is something that happens in the titling, that I'm pointing to this genre of sort of modern or contemporary classical music called holy minimalism, that takes the paring down of minimalistic music but sort of spiritualizes it. And I see like an interesting parallel there to how I see what I'm doing to the type of paring down or flattening out that happened in the more analytical movements of pictures generation, or that type of critical appropriation that was in many ways the art that I really related to and understood as an art student, but felt that, you know, the need to go back into reality and engage with it, but try to do that on the basis of these new lessons, sort of this new level of understanding. So here I'm pushing, I feel that I'm pushing sort of into a very sort of sweet, almost like illustrative or theatrical mode with the idea of this classical music in nature. So it's almost like more folk art, that I'm embracing these motifs that have a very long traditions in different pictorial traditions.
And the pictorial tradition you're talking about, among others, is the pictures generation. I mean, that was a group of notorious artists that had a few very famous exhibits in New York.
Yes, and I'm trying to say something about how I relate to it, how I try to move on or turn lessons from that human generation on its head and take seriously a lot of the things that were played around with or seen or shown as sort of empty cultural forms by that group at that time. So my starting point is not to find energy in emptying out and showing that things are hollow, but just starting with the sort of the sad state of things being hollow and see, well, can this still have meaning? How can I re-energize these forms? How can I re-mystify the world? How can I try to find meaning just using these languages that are still available to me?
Yeah, I love that. So interesting to talk to you about this work. For listeners, I hope you can go see the show. That's the idea here. There's links to learn more, but please go see the show before it closes, because this is one show. I mean, many are like this, but I feel like you have to see it in person. So I want to ask you one more question, Torbjörn, before we go. What are you reading at the moment?
I've been reading a book called The Secret Life of Puppets recently by Victoria Nelson. And it has some relevance to the show because it sort of, in part, reminds us that the puppets that we surround ourselves with used to be our gods. And there is a part where some images in the back of my exhibition at Gdansky that features nativity figures that I bought when I was at a big studio in Berlin in 23. And so there are human figures seen interacting with these kind of large nativity figures. And this book has been very interesting to just put some flesh and some ideas around this relationship between humans and puppets.
I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. I wish you well with this show. And again, listeners, I hope you get to see this show. I can't encourage you more. Thank you so much for talking with me today and for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.